Inside was an apartment in a large house at the foot of the marble stairs. Windows looked out on what Johnny called the piazza, and I could see up the staircase to a large yellow-brown church above, and down to the square where a boat-shaped fountain tossed water into the evening stillness. Johnny said that the fountain had been designed by Bernini, but the name meant nothing to me. The rooms were small but high-ceilinged, with rough but elaborately carved furniture from an era I did not recognize. There was no sign of electricity or modern appliances. The house did not respond when I spoke to it at the door and again in the apartment upstairs. As dusk fell over the square and city outside the tall windows, the only lights were a few street lamps of gas or some more primitive combustible. "This is out of Old Earth's past," I said, touching the thick pillows. I raised my head, suddenly understanding. "Keats died in Italy, early 19th or 20th century. This is then." "Yes, early 19th century, 1821 to be precise." "The whole world is a museum?" "Oh, no. Different areas are different eras, of course. It depends upon the analog being pursued." "I don't understand." We had moved into a room cluttered with thick furniture, and I sat on an oddly carved couch by a window. A film of gold evening light still touched the spire of the tawny church up the steps. Pigeons wheeled white against blue sky. "Are there millions of people, Cybrids, living on this fake old earth?" "I do not believe so," said Johnny. "Only the number necessary for the particular analog project." He saw that I still did not understand and took a breath before continuing. "When I awoke here, there were Cybrid analogs of Joseph Severn, Dr. Clark, the landlady, Anna Angeletti, young Lieutenant Elton, and a few others. Italian shopkeepers, the owner of the trattoria across the square who used to bring us our food, passers-by, that sort of thing. No more than a score at the most." "What happened to them?" "They were probably recycled, like the man with the queue." "Queue?" I suddenly stared across the darkening room at Johnny. "He was a Cybrid?" "Without doubt. The self-destruction you described is precisely the way I would rid myself of this Cybrid if I had to." My mind was racing. I realized how stupid I had been, how little I had learned about anything. "Then it was another AI who tried to kill you?"
"It seems that way."
"Why?" Johnny made a gesture with his hands.
"Possibly to erase some quantum of knowledge that died with my Cybrid. Something I had learned only recently, and the other AI, or AIs, knew would be destroyed in my system's crash."
I stood, paced back and forth, and stopped at the window. The darkness was settling in earnest now. There were lamps in the room, but Johnny made no move to light them, and I preferred the dimness. It made the unreality of what I was hearing even that much more unreal. I looked into the bedroom. The western windows admitted the last of the light. Bedclothes glowed whitely.
"You died here," I said.
"He did," said Johnny. "I am not he." "But you have his memories."
"Half-forgotten dreams. There are gaps."
"But you know what he felt?"
"I remember what the designers thought that he felt."
"Tell me."
"What?"
Johnny's skin was very pale in the gloom. His short curls looked black. "What it was like to die. What it was like to be reborn." Johnny told me, his voice very soft, almost melodic,
lapsing sometimes into an English too archaic to be understood, but far more beautiful to the ear than the hybrid tongue we speak today. He told me what it was like to be a poet obsessed with perfection, far harsher toward his own efforts than even the most vicious critic. And the critics were vicious. His work was dismissed, ridiculed, described as derivative and silly. Too poor to marry the woman he loved, loaning money to his brother in America, and thus losing the last chance of financial security, and then the brief glory of growing into the full maturation of his poetic powers, just as he fell prey to the consumption which had claimed his mother and his brother Tom. Then, sent off to exile in Italy, reputedly for his health, while knowing all the while it meant a lonely, painful death at the age of 26. He talked of the agony of seeing Fanny's handwriting on the letters he found too painful to open. He talked of the loyalty of the young artist Joseph Severn, who had been chosen as a traveling companion for Keats by friends who had abandoned the poet at the end, of how Severn had nursed the dying man and stayed with him during the final days. He told of the hemorrhages in the night, of Dr. Clark bleeding him and prescribing exercise and good air, and of the ultimate religious and personal despair which had led Keats to demand his own epitaph be carved in stone as, "Here lies one whose name was writ in water." Only the dimmest light from below outlined the tall windows. Johnny's voice seemed to float in the night-scented air. He spoke of awakening after his death in the bed where he died, still attended by the loyal Severn and Dr. Clark, of remembering that he was the poet John Keats, the way one remembers an identity from a fast-fading dream, while all the while knowing that he was something else. He told of the illusion continued, the trip back to England, the reunion with the Fanny who was not Fanny, and the near mental breakdown this had engendered. He told of his inability to write further poetry, of his increasing estrangement from the Cybrid impostors, of his retreat into something resembling catatonia, combined with hallucinations of his true AI existence in the nearly incomprehensible, to a 19th-century poet, technocore, and of the ultimate crumbling of the illusion and the abandonment of the Keats Project. "In truth," he said, "the entire evil charade made me think of nothing so much as a passage in a letter I wrote. He wrote to his brother George some time before his illness. Keats said, 'May there not be superior beings amused with any graceful, though instinctive attitude my mind may fall into, as I am entertained with the alertness of a stoat or the anxiety of a deer? Though a quarrel in the streets is a thing to be hated, the energies displayed in it are fine. By a superior being our reasonings may take the same tone, though erroneous they may be fine. This is the very thing in which consists poetry.'" "You think the Keats Project was evil?" I asked. "Anything which deceives is evil, I believe." "Perhaps you are more John Keats than you are willing to admit." "No. The absence of poetic instinct showed otherwise, even in the midst of the most elaborate illusion." I looked at the dark outlines of shapes in the dark house. "Do the AIs know that we're here?" "Probably. Almost surely. There is no place that I can go that the technocore cannot trace and follow. But it was the web authorities and brigands from whom we fled, no? But you know now that it was someone, some intelligence in the technocore, who assaulted you." "Yes, but only in the web. such violence in the core would not be tolerated. There came a noise from the street, a pigeon, I hoped. Wind blowing trash across cobblestones, perhaps. I said, how will the Technocore respond to my being here? I have no idea. Surely it must be a secret. It is. Something they consider irrelevant to humanity. I shook my head, a futile gesture in the darkness. The recreation of old Earth, the resurrection of how many human personalities as cybrids on this recreated world? AIs killing AIs? Irrelevant? I laughed, but managed to keep the laughter under control. Jesus wept, Johnny. Almost certainly. I moved to the window, not caring what sort of target I would afford anyone in the dark street below, and fumbled out a cigarette. They were damp from the afternoon's chase through the snowdrifts, but one lighted when I struck it. Johnny, earlier, when you said that the old Earth analog was complete, I said, why, for God's sake, and you said something like, that may be the case. Was that just a wise-ass comment, or did you mean something? I mean that it might indeed be for God's sake. Explain. Johnny sighed in the darkness. I don't understand the exact purpose of the Keats Project or the other Old Earth analogs, but I suspect that it is part of a Technocore project going back at least 7 standard centuries to realize the ultimate intelligence. The ultimate intelligence, I said, exhaling smoke. Uh-huh. So the Technocore is trying to... what? To build God? Yes. Why? There is no simple answer, Braun. Any more than there is no simple answer to the question of why humankind has sought God in a million guises for 10,000 generations. But with the core, the interest lies more in the quest for more efficiency, more reliable ways to handle variables. But the Technocore can draw on itself and the mega-datasphere of 200 worlds. And there still will be blanks in the predictive powers. I threw my cigarette out the window, watching the ember fall into the night. The breeze was suddenly cold. I hugged my arms. How does all this... Old Earth, the resurrection projects, the cybrids... how does it lead to creating the ultimate intelligence? I don't know, Braun. 8 standard centuries ago, at the beginning of the first information age, a man named Norbert Wiener wrote, "Can God play a significant game with his own creature? Can any creator, even a limited one, play a significant game with his own creature?" Humanity dealt with this inconclusively with their early AIs. The core wrestles with it in the resurrection projects. Perhaps the UI program has been completed, and all of this remains a function of the ultimate creature creator, a personality whose motives are as far beyond the core's understanding as the core's are beyond humanity's. I started to move in the dark room, bumped a low table with my knee, and remained standing. None of which tells us who is trying to kill you, I said. No. Johnny rose and moved to the far wall. A match flared and he lighted a candle. Our shadows wavered on the walls and ceiling. Johnny came closer and softly gripped my upper arms. The soft light painted his curls and eyelashes copper and touched his high cheekbones and firm chin. Why are you so tough? He asked. I stared at him. His face was only inches from mine. We were the same height. Let go, I said. Instead, he leaned forward and kissed me. His lips were soft and warm, and the kiss seemed to last for hours. He's a machine, I thought. Human, but a machine behind that. I closed my eyes. His soft hand touched my cheek, my neck, the back of my head. Listen, I whispered when we broke apart for an instant. Johnny did not let me finish. He lifted me in his arms and carried me into the other room, the tall bed, the soft mattress and deep comforter. The candlelight from the other room flickered and danced as we undressed each other in a sudden urgency. We made love 3 times that night, each time responding to slow, sweet imperatives of touch and warmth and closeness and the escalating intensity of sensation. I remember looking down at him the 2nd time. His eyes were closed, hair fell loosely across his forehead, the candlelight showing the flush across his pale chest, his surprisingly strong arms and hands rising to hold me in place. He had opened his eyes that second to look back at me, and I saw only the emotion and passion of that moment reflected there. Sometime before dawn we slept, and just as I turned away and drifted off, I felt the cool touch of his hand on my hip in a movement protective and casual without being possessive. They hit us just after first light. There were 5 of them, not Lussian, but heavily muscled, all men, and they worked well together as a team. The first I heard them was when the door to the apartment was kicked open. I rolled out of bed, jumped to the side of the bedroom door, and watched them come through. Johnny sat up and shouted something as the first man leveled a stunner. Johnny had pulled on cotton shorts before going to sleep. I was nude. There are real disadvantages to fighting in the nude when one's opponents are dressed, but the greatest problem is psychological. If you can get over the sense of heightened vulnerability, the rest is easy to compensate for. The first man saw me, decided to stun Johnny anyway, and paid for the mistake. I kicked the weapon out of his hand and clubbed him down with a blow behind the left ear. 2 more men pushed into the room. This time, both of them were smart enough to deal with me first. 2 others leaped for Johnny. I blocked a stiff-fingered jab, parried a kick that would have done real damage, and backed away. There was a tall dresser to my left, and the top drawer came out smooth and heavy. The big man in front of me shielded his face with both arms so that the thick wood splintered, but the instinctive reaction gave me a second's opening, and I took it, putting my entire body into the kick. Number 2 man grunted and fell back against his partner. Johnny was struggling, but one of the intruders had him around the throat in a chokehold while the other pinned his legs. I came off the floor in a crouch, accepted the blow from my number 2, and leaped across the bed. The guy holding Johnny's legs went through the glass and wood of the window without a word. Someone landed on my back, and I completed the roll across the bed and floor, bringing him up against the wall. He was good. He took the blow on his shoulder and went for a nerve pinch beneath my ear. He had a second of trouble because of the extra layers of muscle there, and I got an elbow deep into his stomach and rolled away. The man choking Johnny dropped him and delivered a textbook perfect kick to my ribs. I took half the impact, feeling at least 1 rib go, and spun inside, attempting no elegance as I used my left hand to crush his left testicle. The man screamed and was out of it. I'd never forgotten the stunner on the floor, and neither had the last of the opposition. He scurried around to the far side of the bed, out of reach, and dropped to all fours to grab the weapon. Definitely feeling the pain from the broken rib now, I lifted the massive bed with Johnny in it and dropped it on the guy's head and shoulders. I went under the bed from my side, retrieved the stunner, and backed into an empty corner. 1 guy had gone out the window. We were on the 2nd floor.
The first man to enter was still lying in the doorway. The guy I'd kicked had managed to get to one knee and both elbows. From the blood on his mouth and chin, I guessed that a rib had punctured a lung. He was breathing very raggedly. The bed had crushed the skull of the other man on the floor. The guy who'd been choking Johnny was curled up near the window, holding his crotch and vomiting. I stunned him into silence and went over to the one I'd kicked and lifted him by the hair. "Who sent you?" "Fuck you!" He sprayed some bloody spittle in my face. "Maybe later," I said. "Again, who sent you?" I placed three fingers against his side where the ribcage seemed concave and pressed. The man screamed and went very white. When he coughed, the blood was too red against pale skin. "Who sent you?" I set four fingers against his ribs. "The bishop!" He tried to levitate away from my fingers. "What bishop?" "Shrike Temple. Lussus. Don't. Please. Oh, shit. What were you going to do with him? Us. Nothing. Oh, god damn. Don't. I need a medic. Please." "Sure. Answer." "Stun him. Bring him back to the temple. Lussus. Please. I can't breathe." "And me?" "Kill you if you resisted." "Okay," I said, lifting him a little higher by his hair. "We're doing fine here. What did they want him for?"
"I don't know."
He screamed very loudly. I kept one eye on the doorway to the apartment. The stunner was still in my palm under a fistful of hair.
"I don't know,"
he gasped. He was hemorrhaging in earnest now. The blood dripped on my arm and left breast.
"How'd you get here?"
"EMV. Roof."
"Where'd you cast in?"
"Don't know. I swear. Some city in the water. Car's set to return there. Please."
I ripped at his clothes. No comm log, no other weapons. There was a tattoo of a blue trident just above his heart.
"Gunda?"
I said.
"Yeah, Parvati Brotherhood."
Outside the web, probably very hard to trace. "All of you?"
"Yeah, please. Get me some help. Oh, shit. Please."
He sagged, almost unconscious. I dropped him, stepped back, and sprayed the stun beam over him. Johnny was sitting up, rubbing his throat and staring at me with a strange gaze.
"Get dressed," I said. "We're leaving."
The EMV was an old transparent Vic and Scenic with no palm locks on the ignition plate or disc key. We caught up to the Terminator before we had crossed France and looked down on darkness that Johnny said was the Atlantic Ocean. Except for lights of the occasional floating city or drilling platform, the only illumination came from the stars and the broad swimming pool glows of the undersea colonies.
"Why are we taking their vehicle?" asked Johnny.
"I want to see where they farcast from."
"He said the Lusses Shrike Temple."
"Yeah, now we'll see." Johnny's face was barely visible as he looked down at the dark sea 20 clicks below.
"Do you think those men will die?"
"One was already dead," I said. "The guy with the punctured lung will need help. Two of them'll be okay. I don't know about the one who went out the window."
"Do you care?"
"Yes. The violence was barbaric. Though a quarrel in the street is a thing to be hated, the energies displayed in it are fine," I quoted.
They weren't cybrids, were they?
I think not.
So there are at least two groups out to get you. The AIs and the Bishop of the Shrike Temple, and we still don't know why.
I do have an idea now.
I swiveled in the foam recliner. The constellations above us, familiar neither from hollows of old Earth skies nor from any web world I knew, cast just enough light to allow me to see Johnny's eyes. Tell me, I said.
Your mention of Hyperion gave me a clue, he said. The fact that I had no knowledge of it, its absence said that it was important.
The strange case of the dog barking in the night, I said.
What?
Nothing. Go on. Johnny leaned closer.
The only reason that I would not be aware of it is that some elements of the Technocore have blocked my knowledge of it.
Your cybrid... It was strange to talk to Johnny that way now. You spend most of your time in the web, don't you?
Yes.
Wouldn't you run across mention of Hyperion somewhere? It's in the news every once in a while, especially when the Shrike cult's topical.
Perhaps I did hear. Perhaps that is why I was murdered.
I lay back and looked at the stars. Let's go ask the bishop, I said. Johnny said that the lights ahead were an analog of New York City in the mid-21st century. He didn't know what resurrection project the city had been rebuilt for. I took the EMV off auto and dropped lower. Tall buildings from the phallic symbol era of urban architecture rose from the swamps and lagoons of the North American littoral. Several had lights burning. Johnny pointed to one decrepit but oddly elegant structure and said,
"The Empire State Building."
"Okay," I said. "Whatever it is, that's where the EMV wants to land."
"Is it safe?"
I grinned at him.
"Nothing in life's safe."
I let the car have its head, and we dropped to a small, open platform below the building's spire. We got out and stood on the cracked balcony. It was quite dark, except for the few building lights far below and the stars. A few paces away, a vague blue glow outlined a Farcaster portal where elevator doors may once have been. "I'll go first," I said, but Johnny had already stepped through. I palmed the borrowed stunner and followed him. I'd never been in the Shrike Temple on Lussus before, but there was no doubt that we were there now. Johnny stood a few paces ahead of me, but other than him, there was no one around. The place was cool and dark and cavernous, if caverns could really be that large. A frightening polychrome sculpture, which hung from invisible cables, rotated to unfelt breezes. Johnny and I both turned as the Farcaster portal winked out of existence.
"Well, we did their work for them, didn't we?" I whispered to Johnny.
Even the whisper seemed to echo in the red-lit hall. I hadn't planned on Johnny casting to the temple with me. The light seemed to come up then, not really illuminating the great hall, but widening its scope so that we could see the semicircle of men there. I remembered that some were called exorcists, and others lectors, and there was some other category I forgot. Whoever they were, it was alarming to see them standing there, at least two dozen of them, their robes variations on red and black, and their high foreheads glowing from the red light above. I had no trouble recognizing the bishop. He was from my world, although shorter and fatter than most of us, and his robe was very red. I did not try to hide the stunner. It was possible that if they all tried to rush us, I could bring them all down. Possible, but not probable. I could not see any weapons, but their robes could have hidden entire arsenals. Johnny walked toward the bishop, and I followed. 10 paces from the man, we stopped. The bishop was the only one not standing. His chair was made of wood and looked as if it could be folded so that the intricate arms, supports, back, and legs could be carried in a compact form. One couldn't say the same for the mass of muscle and fat evident under the bishop's robes. Johnny took another step forward.
"Why did you try to kidnap my Cybrid?"
He spoke to the Shrike cult holy man as if the rest of us were not there. The bishop chuckled and shook his head.
"My dear entity, it is true that we wished your presence in our place of worship, but you have no evidence that we were involved in any attempt to kidnap you."
"I'm not interested in evidence," said Johnny.
"I'm curious as to why you want me here."
I heard a rustling behind us, and I swiveled quickly. The stunner charged and pointed, but the broad circle of Shrike priests remained motionless. Most were out of the stunner's range. I wished that I had brought my father's projectile weapon with me. The bishop's voice was deep and textured and seemed to fill the huge space.
"Surely you know that the Church of the Final Atonement has a deep and abiding interest in the world of Hyperion."
"Yes."
"And surely you are aware that during the past several centuries, the persona of the Old Earth poet Keats has been woven into the cultural mythos of the Hyperion colony?"
"Yes. So?"
The bishop rubbed his cheek with a large red ring on one finger.
"So, when you offered to go on the Shrike pilgrimage, we agreed. We were distressed when you reneged on this offer."
Johnny's look of amazement was most human.
"I offered? When?"
8 local days ago," said the bishop. "In this room, you approached us with the idea."
"Did I say why I wanted to go on the Shrike pilgrimage?"
"You said that it was, I believe the phrase you used was, important for your education. We can show you the recording if you wish. All such conversations in the temple are recorded, or you may have a duplicate of the recording to view at your own convenience."
"Yes," said Johnny.
The bishop nodded, and an acolyte, or whatever the hell he was, disappeared into the gloom for a moment and returned with a standard video chip in his hand. The bishop nodded again, and the black-robed man came forward and handed the chip to Johnny. I kept the stunner ready until the guy had returned to the semicircle of watchers.
"Why did you send the Goondas after us?" I asked.
It was the first time I'd spoken in front of the bishop, and my voice sounded too loud and too raw. The Shrike holy man made a gesture with one pudgy hand.
"M. Keats had expressed an interest in joining our holiest pilgrimage. Since it is our belief that the final atonement is drawing closer each day, this is of no little importance to us. Consequently, our agents reported that M. Keats may have been the victim of one or more assaults, and that a certain private investigator, you, M. Lamia, was responsible for destroying the Cybrid bodyguard provided M. Keats by the Technocorps."
"Bodyguard?"
It was my turn to sound amazed.
"Of course,"
said the bishop. He turned toward Johnny.
"The gentleman with the queue who was recently murdered on the Templar excursion, was this not the same man whom you introduced as your bodyguard a week earlier? He is visible in the recording."
Johnny said nothing. He seemed to be straining to remember something.
"At any rate," continued the bishop, "we must have your answer about the pilgrimage before the week is out,
The Sequoia Sempervirens departs from the web in 9 local days. But that's a Templar tree ship, said Johnny. They don't make the long leap to Hyperion. The bishop smiled. In this case, it does. We have reason to believe that this may be the last church-sponsored pilgrimage, and we have chartered the Templar craft to allow as many of the faithful as possible to make the trip. The bishop gestured, and red and black-robed men faded back into darkness. 2 exorcists came forward to fold his stool as the bishop stood. Please give us your answer as soon as possible. He was gone. The remaining exorcist stayed to show us out. There were no more Farcasters. We exited by the main door of the temple and stood on the top step of the long staircase, looking down on the concourse mall of Hive Center and breathing in the cool, oil-scented air. My father's automatic was in the drawer where I'd left it. I made sure there was a full load of flechettes, palmed the magazine back in, and carried the weapon into the kitchen where breakfast was cooking. Johnny sat at the long table, staring down through gray windows at the loading dock. I carried the omelets over and set one in front of him. He looked up as I poured the coffee. "Do you believe him?" I asked. "That it was your idea?" "You saw the video recording. Recordings can be faked." "Yes, but this one wasn't." "Then why did you volunteer to go on this pilgrimage? And why did your bodyguard try to kill you after you talked to the Shrike Church and the Templar captain?" Johnny tried the omelet, nodded, and took another forkful. "The bodyguard is a complete unknown to me. He must have been assigned to me during the week lost to memory. His real purpose, obviously, was to make sure that I did not discover something, or, if I did stumble upon it, to eliminate me." "Something in the web or in Datum Plane?"
"In the web, I presume."
"We need to know who he... it worked for and why they assigned him to you."
"I do know," said Johnny. "I just asked. The Corps responds that I requested a bodyguard. The cybrid was controlled by an AI nexus, which corresponds to a security force."
"Ask why he tried to kill you."
"I did. They emphatically deny that such a thing is possible."
"Then why was this so-called bodyguard slinking around after you a week after the murder?"
"They respond that while I did not request security again after my discontinuity, the Corps authorities felt that it would be prudent to provide protection."
I laughed.
"Some protection? Why the hell did he run on the Templar world when I caught up to him? They aren't even trying to give you a plausible story, Johnny."
"No.
Nor did the bishop explain how the Shrike Church had Farcaster access to Old Earth, or whatever you call that stage-set world."
"And we did not ask."
"I didn't ask because I wanted to get out of that damn temple in one piece."
Johnny didn't seem to hear. He was sipping his coffee, his gaze focused somewhere else.
"What?" I said. He turned to look at me, tapping his thumbnail on his lower lip.
"There is a paradox here, Braun."
"What?"
"If it was truly my aim to go to Hyperion, for my cybrid to travel there, I could not have remained in the Technocorps. I would have had to invest all consciousness in the cybrid itself."
"Why?" But even as I asked, I saw the reason.
"Think. Datum Plane itself is an abstract, a commingling of computer and AI-generated data spheres, and the quasi-perceptual Gibsonian matrix designed originally for human operators
now accepted as common ground for man, machine, and AI. But AI hardware exists somewhere in real space, I said, somewhere in the technocore. Yes, but that is irrelevant to the function of AI consciousness, said Johnny. I can be anywhere the overlapping data spheres allow me to travel. All of the web worlds, of course, datum plane, and any of the technocore constructs such as Old Earth, but it's only within that milieu that I can claim consciousness or operate sensors or remotes such as this cybrid. I set my coffee cup down and stared at the thing I had loved as a man during the night just past. Yes? The colony worlds have limited data spheres, said Johnny. While there is some contact with the technocore via fatline transmissions, it is an exchange of data only, rather like the first information age computer interfaces, rather than a flow of consciousness. Hyperion's data sphere is primitive to the point of non-existence, and from what I can access, the core has no contact whatsoever with that world. Would that be normal? I asked. I mean, with a colony world that far away? No, the core has contact with every colony world, with such interstellar barbarians as the Ousters, and with other sources the hegemony could not imagine. I sat stunned. With the Ousters? Since the war on Brescia a few years earlier, the Ousters had been the web's prime boogeymen. The idea of the Core, the same congregation of AIs which advises the Senate and the All-Thing, and which allow our entire economy, Farcaster system, and technological civilization to run, the idea of the Core being in touch with the Ousters was frightening. And what the hell did Johnny mean by other sources? I didn't really want to know right then. But you said it is possible for your cybrid to travel there, I said. What did you mean by investing all consciousness in your cybrid? Can an AI become human? Can you exist only in your cybrid? It has been done, Johnny said softly. Once. A personality reconstruction not too different from my own. A 20th century poet named Ezra Pound. He abandoned his AI persona and fled from the web in his cybrid, but the Pound reconstruction was insane. Or sane, I said. Yes. So all of the data and personality of an AI can survive in a cybrid's organic brain? Of course not, Braun. Not 1% of 1% of my total consciousness would survive the transition. Organic brains can't process even the most primitive information the way we can. The resultant personality would not be the AI persona, neither would it be a truly human consciousness or cybrid. Johnny stopped in mid-sentence and turned quickly to look out the window. After a long minute, I said, "What is it?" I reached out a hand, but did not touch him. He spoke without turning. "Perhaps I was wrong to say that the consciousness would not be human," he whispered. "It is possible that the resulting persona could be human, touched with a certain divine madness and meta-human perspective. It could be, if purged of all memory of our age, of all consciousness of the core, it could be the person the cybrid was programmed to be." "John Keats," I said. Johnny turned away from the window and closed his eyes. His voice was hoarse with emotion. It was the first time I had heard him recite poetry. "Fanatics have their dreams,
wherewith they weave a paradise for a sect. The savage, too, from forth the loftiest fashion of his sleep, guesses at heaven. Pity these have not traced upon vellum, or wild Indian leaf, the shadows of melodious utterance. But bare of laurel they live, dream, and die, for poesy alone can tell her dreams. With the fine spell of words alone can save imagination from the sable charm and dumb enchantment. Who alive can say, "Thou art no poet, mayst not tell thy dreams," since every man whose soul is not a clod hath visions and would speak if he had loved and been well nurtured in his mother tongue. Whether the dream now purposed to rehearse be poets or fanatics will be known when this warm scribe, my hand, is in the grave.
"I don't get it," I said. "What does it mean?"
"It means," said Johnny, smiling gently, "that I know what decision I made and why I made it. I wanted to cease being a cybrid and become a man. I wanted to go to Hyperion. I still do."
"Somebody killed you for that decision a week ago," I said.
"Yes."
"And you're going to try again?"
"Yes."
"Why not invest consciousness in your cybrid here, become human in the web?"
"It would never work," said Johnny.
"What you see as a complex interstellar society is only a small part of the core reality matrix. I would be constantly confronted with and at the mercy of the AIs. The Keats persona, reality, would never survive."
"All right," I said. "You need to get out of the web, but there are other colonies. Why Hyperion?"
Johnny took my hand. His fingers were long and warm and strong.
"Don't you see, Braun? There is some connection here. It may well be that Keats's dreams of Hyperion were some sort of transtemporal communication between his then-persona and his now-persona. If nothing else, Hyperion is the key mystery of our age, physical and poetic, and it is quite probable that I was born, died, and was born again to explore it."
"It sounds like madness to me," I said. "Delusions of grandeur."
"Almost certainly," laughed Johnny. "And I never have been happier."
He grabbed my arms and brought me to my feet, his arms around me.
"Will you go with me, Braun? Go with me to Hyperion?"
I blinked in surprise, both at his question and the answer, which filled me like a rush of warmth.
"Yes," I said.
"I'll go." We went into the sleeping area then, and made love the rest of that day, sleeping, finally to awaken to the low light of shift 3 in the industrial trench outside. Johnny was lying on his back, his hazel eyes open and staring at the ceiling, lost in thought. But not so lost he did not smile and put his arm around me. I nestled my cheek against him, settling into the small curve where shoulder meets chest, and went back to sleep.